Hey everybody, a quick intro here. Just wanted to remind people that Penn & Teller have a new YouTube channel. Just search Penn & Teller, and the new video is called The Ambitious Card. It's Penn & Teller and Friends doing a very cool, unique take on the classic Ambitious Card. And also, Penn & Teller Fool Us starts back up Monday, June 22nd on the CW Network, so make sure to check that out. Thanks to everybody who's been supporting the show. If you want to be a monthly supporter and donate a buck or two a month on our Patreon, it's just patreon.com/2magicians1mic or on our website, 2magicians1mic.com. Thanks, everybody, and enjoy the episode.
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
Well, then here I am on my headphones in the Houdini alcove.
Oh, that's so cool.
I'll guide you around it a little bit.
Oh, cool.
That big thing is a cross that was in his collection of unpleasant things to escape from. It's a carnival item. Mm. It would be erected on stage, and the person who's doing the spiel on the ballet would take usually a runaway 13 or 14-year-old drug-addicted girl who happens to be with a carnival and tie her neck and wrists to this cross. And then at the moment when they were trying to turn the tip and bring the whole group into the tent, all of a sudden she'd just walk away from it. The ties would be gone. It's got an elaborate internal mechanism with blades that slice the ropes that have been tied around it at the critical moment if you just jab your heel into a particular place on the cross.
That's brilliant.
Back over here, there's other stuff. There's the first letter that Houdini wrote to his brother after his mother died, where he says, "Dash, it's tough, I can't seem to get over it. Sometimes I'm all right, but when a quiet moment arrives, I'm as bad as ever." And the letter that you see there in the green velvet mat is a letter to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle after they had their first big split. You know, when Houdini was in Atlantic City, he hung out with Doyle, and Doyle's wife gave a famous automatic reading that you've probably read about, where, you know, it was a letter from Houdini's mother, and you know, she was off in a trance, and Houdini had been very close friends with them for a long time and liked them very much. And he, you know, he took the letter and he was moved at the time, actually, I think moved to tears. And then he, you know, in a moment after he had a chance to reflect on it, he realized there were a few things wrong with the letter. One, it didn't really contain anything evidential. There wasn't anything that only his mother could know that he could be told to him. And two, it was written in English, which was a language that his mother did not speak. Never, she lived in the United States for a long time, but never spoke English. Never learned it. And three, at the top of the letter there was a cross, not exactly the first thing the rabbi's wife would draw.
Yeah, it's. It is amazing how Conan Doyle, just who wrote one of the smartest characters in fiction, was such not the same himself when it came to evidence-based thinking.
You know, you can understand that, though, you know, with his son dying in World War I.
Yeah.
He didn't die of battle wounds. He died of disease, I think, something like malaria. But, you know, the death of a child is just about the worst thing that can happen to you and is likely to unbalance you, combined with, of course, that, you know, that British thing of I'm very well educated, so you can't fool me. Yeah. Well, we all know how well that works.
We didn't do a formal intro. If you don't mind, I'm going to keep all that because that was absurdly fascinating.
Okay.
Thanks for coming. This is Two Magicians with Mike. My name is Nick Paul. That's Simon Cornell. And today we have Teller. Thanks so much for being with us, Teller.
It's my pleasure. It's nice to be with friends while I'm alone.
What's changed about your life with this whole pandemic?
Well,
apart from the obvious.
Yes, the obvious thing of I'm not doing the show every night at 9 o'clock, which means I'm going to bed earlier, which is probably good for me. I'm eating very carefully. I'm swimming for an hour a day, and 6 days a week I'm working out via FaceTime with a trainer who's also my physical therapist, who knows all my little foibles. So I expect to come out of this, if I don't die, I expect to come out of this healthier than I was when I went into it.
And like, you just got out of serious back surgery, correct?
I had a real bad spell over the last 2.5 years where I had basically 3 back operations, and I believe that everything is now in very good shape, and that's good. And I'm very happy to be back and working again and not in excruciating pain, which I was doing for a while. You know, I'd sort of go on stage and smile my cheerful teller smile, step into the wings, squat to relieve the pressure on my lower back, scream, and then stand up and walk back on stage smiling again, which I guess is really stupid, isn't it?
It's not ideal. In terms of not doing the show, are you finding it going stir crazy, or are you kind of enjoying the vacation, or a combination of both?
Well, it's both, really. I love doing the show, and it's always the high point of my day. It is that wonderful jolt of satisfying adrenaline. Mm. It's a large jolt of, you know, simply ego gratification, because the audience generally likes what we do, and that's it's nice to have people go, oh, we like you. I miss that tremendously. And at the same time, for the last probably 5 years, the combination of these surgeries and the incredibly intense work schedule has made me frequently say, oh, couldn't I have just some time off, like some spa time? And so I'm getting that in spades, and that's okay. I'm fine with everything. I've been very, very lucky most of my life. Yeah. And this is another situation where so far I've been lucky.
Yeah. I've been experiencing a similar thing for different reasons. I really kind of needed some downtime, and the fact this pandemic is obviously a terrible thing, but it has had some silver linings for a bunch of us more fortunate, privileged people.
I've talked to so many performers that are kind of, yeah, going through that too, myself included, of this is just like a mandatory vacation. And it's helpful, but I'm happy to know when it's going to be finished as well too. I do miss getting up on stage.
Well, that's the weird thing about this is not knowing how long things are going to go on, or exactly what's happening. So it's a serious chance to adjust your philosophy to one. I mean, we never know what's going to happen tomorrow, but now we really never know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Sure. Yeah.
So this is a chance philosophically to address that.
It's a weird Zen thing of just truly living in the moment, because you have no clue.
Have you noticed, in terms of your own philosophical adjustment, any takeaways so far from your point of view, both for you personally or anyone else at large?
No, I've noticed a change in my sense of time. That more than anything, days are shorter now. Mm. And that's Penn pointed that out to me yesterday. He said, "Have you noticed how short days have become? You know, you get up and you do a few things, and then it's bedtime already." Mm-hmm. And that really is true. For someone who's, you know, used to having the high point of his day be at 9 o'clock at night, and now at 9 o'clock at night is when I'm thinking about taking my bath and reading and going to bed.
Yeah.
It seems like the days have shrunk. I would imagine this is, you know, more closely akin to what it was like back in the candlelight days.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's something that is well known, that if you want to, again, time moves faster as we get older. That's well documented. But if you want time to go slower, the more different your days are, the slower it goes. The more the same they are, the faster they blink by. And we're all kind of in that position right now.
Yeah. I also don't normally spend 2 hours a day on fitness stuff. You know, then that's 2 hours a day that's just, you know, sort of gone. But I'm so glad to have it, because, you know, all the back surgeries did not give me an opportunity to retain my physical tone very well. So maybe I can get back to that.
Potential blessing in disguise, even with all the drawbacks. I was also thinking about you have, like most Vegas performers, this incredible show schedule of doing the same thing again and again, night in, night out, every week. And when I've done, I mean, Nick and I did a bunch of things like that together, I found myself going insane from the repetition. But you and Penn are in this great place where, because you're constantly cycling in new material, you get to retain that excitement, I believe. Is that how you experience it?
Yes. Yes and no. I do not have trouble doing material that I've done before. I do not get bored of it. I just don't. I think it's because it's all really difficult. So that, you know, I mean, you try doing 300 shows of the red ball trick and see if you don't just get better.
Yeah.
Because it's so fucking difficult. And things that are, I mean, by the time we finished the last pre-Fool Us season, I believe maybe there were two old things in the show out of 18. So I always feel sort of desperate to try to get the new stuff good enough in time. And fortunately, you know, when it goes on TV, you do have the luxury of choosing camera angles at least. Yeah. You know, and that can help. That can help make stuff that was not quite ripe seem riper. Mm-hmm. But you know, we and of course the back surgery happened in December, so a lot of the work that we did was leading up to that, and then I was off for that period of time, and then when we came back, we were intensely putting the material into the show. And again, it's none of it is easy material. None of it is virtually none of it was just adapted from some previous composition, but so there was just tons to do all the time. And you know, this year we didn't have our usual critic Johnny Thompson, because sure. You know, he died last year during the shooting of Fool Us. And you know, the great thing about Johnny is he was so generous all the time, that he taught us a lot. A lot of what was in him is now in us and our crew. I mean, he really lives, I mean, literally lives on in what we learned from him about how to watch things, about how to solve problems, all of those things. If any of your listeners don't know, Johnny Thompson is a well-known Las Vegas magician and magic consultant, famous for his act, the Thomasonian Company, which is the, you know, the one hilariously funny dove act that anybody ever did, in which he plays a pompous Polish magician, and his wife plays a very skeptical, dragged along for the ride, over the hill showgirl who has no patience at all with Johnny. And Johnny was, I believe, at the time, the most knowledgeable magician on earth. And we worked with him for about 20 years or so. But he was 84 and, you know, in dubious health, and we were very sad to lose him. But now working is a different thing. One of the things we found is that all the stuff that our crew has absorbed from Johnny, now our crew has become very good watchers of magic.
Yeah.
So, you know, they don't just check angles, but they say, that doesn't have enough, that movement doesn't have enough violence to it, or something along that line. You know, you're taking too long with that. So we now have a different set of watchers. And we also invited Jeff McBride in for a session or two. And of course, he's wildly knowledgeable about everything. And that was very helpful. But you know, we're learning to sort of use the magic community to substitute for the one guy that sort of knew it all.
Yeah.
When did you guys decide to put in, because you do Johnny's famous dove act in the show now, when did you decide to put that into the show?
I don't do it right now. Okay. That was in preparation for last year's Fool Us, and the new material took priority over that.
Oh, okay.
However, for a long time, Penn and I discussed the idea of doing a cover tune. You know, musicians do cover tunes all the time, but mostly magicians just sort of steal from each other. And we thought it would be great to do an absolutely classic act, not in a magic history conference sort of way, but an absolutely classic magic act that from the past. just the way it was done, to just do it really a very solid, honest cover tune. And I was shooting a series of zombie movies which I can send you the link to after this, and you can maybe post it with this. But I was doing a series of zombie movies about what happens when the zombie apocalypse overtakes Vegas. Mm-hmm. And one of the episodes involved me wandering into being shot by Johnny, and then finding myself the guest of Johnny and Pam in their trailer on the outskirts of Las Vegas, where they keep their act in shape by strapping zombies to chairs in the living room of their trailer, and then doing the act for the zombies to see if they can still get laughs out of the zombies. And while we were doing this, and I was watching them do the act, I thought, wait a minute, they've just retired this act. It is an absolute classic of magic. We have the people who are doing it right here to teach it to us. Why don't we make this our cover tune? And I pitched it to Johnny. Johnny pitched it to Pam. Pam was delighted. And the two of them worked with us for about a year and a half to get that into the show. Pam worked with Georgie, our showgirl, to teach her all of the moves and the styles and the method acting thinking, because Johnny and Pam, you know, were both method acting, both trained in, you know, method acting behavior. And so Pam taught Georgie, and Johnny taught me, and my God, that act is hard. Jesus yeah. Christ. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Dove stuff alone, the Dove stuff alone is not falling off a log. It's mm-hmm. juggling of the first, sure. the first magnitude. And then to try on top of that, to do that kind of visual, physical comedy that Johnny was able to do.
Yeah, and so many nuances of facial expression and body language that go into actually making that play. There's so much.
And so much of it is also just who he was.
Yeah.
You know, and he was using all of that. You know, Johnny was angular and natively funny. I mean, he was natively funny, which I'm not. I'm able to get laughs at times by certain kinds of surprises and certain kinds of thinking, but I'm not a funny person. Johnny was a funny person, and that made a big difference.
Yeah, that's I had the pleasure of I only got to see him once live in the close-up room at the castle, and I'm not 100%, but I'm pretty sure he used his age as a misdirection. At one point, I can't remember what the trick was, and the audience is like, "Oh, that's cute. He's an old man," and then he still got them, and it was just mind-blowing. It was so cool to see.
Yeah, my favorite recollection of Johnny is probably this. A few years ago, I co-adapted and co-directed a production of The Tempest by Shakespeare,
who my friend Barbara Robertson was in, and she had a blast.
So. Oh, Barbara was great.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, she was great.
She's the queen of Chicago theater. Shout out to
what
Barbara.
What a wonderful actor. Yeah. And we were rehearsing. We were experimenting. We were experimenting with an idea for Ariel's turning into dogs to scare away some people on stage. And we were looking at this problem from this angle and that angle. And we had the whole cast there. And it was very frustrating, and everybody began to get very tired. And it was about 6 o'clock in the evening, and I sort of walked out. I said, "Let's take a 10-minute break." And I walked out, and I thought, "Well, I'll come back in, and I'll say, okay, we've done a fine job for today. Let's call it for today and go home." So I go out, and I have a cup of tea on the outside the theater, and I come walking down the hall. And as I'm walking down the hall towards the theater, I hear laughter and applause. And I walk a little farther down the hall towards the theater, and there's more laughter and applause. And I walk onto the stage, and I look, and there is Johnny with the entire cast gathered around him doing his, you know, he had not an enormous repertoire of favorite card tricks, but doing the, you know, the cream of his repertoire for those people who were screaming with delight, absolutely screaming with delight. And, and, you know, and applauding, and he had. But when I looked at them all, their eyes were bright. They were ready to go back to work. And I said, "Okay, let's get to it." You know, and we went back and we spent another 3 hours. He had energized them by reminding them of the power that magic has on an audience.
Yeah.
You know, magic has this extreme power on an audience. It isn't like just a play where you're unwillingly giving, where you're willingly giving your make-believe, you're willingly suspending your disbelief. Magic has this sense of that willing suspension of disbelief spilling over into what might be reality. Yeah. And the level of energy that strikes in an audience is so intense. And they did it for those people. And that's when I think of Johnny, I think there's a guy injecting the joy of art into people just by doing wonderful card tricks.
Yeah, for sure.
That story really reminds me of the fact that one of the things we struggle with a lot is as magicians connecting with that sense of wonder ourselves, because you lose it a lot of the time by gaining the ability to create it. And, you know, I would watch someone like Johnny do a card trick and go, oh, that was really nicely executed. But I'm not experiencing that just reality shattering wonder and astonishment. And it's great to watch that happen and be reminded of the power of it, because I find it easy to forget and lose touch with.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned your relationship. You know, I really like how you describe magic, you know, spilling over into reality. How do you see, what's the relationship between magic and theater? Or, I mean, are they different? Are they the same? Is there any philosophy that you've kind of learned over the years with that?
Well, magic is a special subset of theater. Mm. It reminds me a little bit of, there are those wonderful woodcuts and engravings from people like Bruegel and Bosch, in which there's a scene of a bunch of townspeople or a scene from hell, and it has drawn around it a frame. And every once in a while, you'll see one of those in which a foot of somebody who's in the picture sticks out of that frame. And yeah. That foot is, I think, where magic lies. Because, you know, magic does, it's impossible to watch magic passively. It's you know, you can sit there and you can kind of listen to a concert relatively passively. I mean, you might be tapping your foot. You might be singing along with the lyrics. You can watch a play and you can get excited about what, you know, the story that's happening or an actor's performance. But magic, you cannot watch passively because it causes a terrible conflict in you. And that terrible conflict is the signature of magic. It's the conflict between what you see and what you know. You see something happening and you know it can't be happening. And this dissonance that's in yourself makes those two things strike at each other and create a kind of a spark. It is, as I like to say to the public, it's magic is not a comfortable form to watch. You can't just sit back and smile passively because it's a little offensive. It's a little insulting. It's doing to you what you try not to have done to you in everyday life, which is it's fooling you. And there are very few situations in which getting fooled is a good thing. And magic is the signature one of those.
Sure. Yeah.
That makes me think about, I would love to hear your thoughts on this. I've been sort of half forming a theory for a while about why do we as humans actually like magic? And my theory is, like, you're probably familiar with the term that all art is basically about sex or death eventually. Mm-hmm. And whether that's reductionistic or true, but we enjoy things that bring us close to death, like roller coasters or bungee jumping or eating really hot chili, pain, discomfort, but that they're still safe. They're not actually going to kill us. And I think magic is a similar thing. It's got this nastiness, but in an interesting way. It's like really bitter coffee or a really scary bungee jump.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. Magic as really bitter coffee is a really good, yeah. It's a really good image.
Yeah. I mean, somehow manages to make coffee about magic in almost every episode. I don't know how he does it, but it's fascinating.
The coffee analogy, literally, I've been thinking about like the bungee jumping, the roller coasters for years, but the coffee literally occurred to me while you were talking about that with the paint.
It really is. It is like one of those foods that's uncomfortably spicy or bitter.
Not everyone likes it. Some people just find that, oh, no, I don't like it. Nope, not into that. And that's okay.
Yep. There's another sort of theoretical position I've often espoused on magic, which is that since the most important decision we ever make, ever about anything, is what's really going on, right? We have to decide what's really going on, and if we make that, if we make a mistake about that, you know, if we don't realize that this is that the light has turned green and there's a bus coming at us and we step out, we've made a terrible mistake. Or if we employ a chiropractor to cure our flu, that's a terrible mistake. But there is one situation in which making that mistake is harmless. It's a sort of a playground for that difficult thing that is so important in real life. Go to magic, and now we're suddenly in the playground where we can play with that and enjoy making mistakes.
Yeah, jump off a cliff, but with a bungee attached.
Yes, exactly.
But it also makes me think about there is this sort of intense, that on some level we know evolutionarily that if we can't trust our perceptions, we're dead. The tiger's going to get us, the rock's going to hit us, we're going to step off the cliff. And so when we are confronted by this reality that our perceptions are clearly inaccurate, it's, I think on some hindbrain, lizard brain level, it's deeply and profoundly scary and unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
But can be in a really fun, interesting way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, shifting gears a little bit here, a lot of what I do is kind of nonverbal, and I've obviously been inspired by your, whole nonverbal character. Does it ever get strange about just kind of living in that world, or people constantly coming up to you and saying, "Hey, you don't talk"? Like, does that ever get annoying, or is that something you've just kind of embraced over the years? Because that's, I struggle with that a little bit back and forth, because I do a full silent show at times, and it's like, "Oh, it was really nice how you didn't talk," and I'm like, "Well, what about the magic?"
I know that you've made jokes about it. I listened to that story you told on the Moth website where you opened with a joke about that you get credit for just talking. But yeah, do you enjoy?
Oh yeah, well, I remember I was once in Times Square, and it was very crowded, and a cop put out his nightstick in front of my chest and stopped me and said, "Name?" I said, "Teller." He said, "I knew I could make him talk." I stopped talking mostly as a rebellion against what I saw as insipid patter, which is pretty much, I mean, with strong exceptions like the stuff that Simon does, patter is often merely narrative, or it's in some way insulting. I mean, you say, "Here, I have a red ball." Well, yeah. Or, it's insulting. It's, stuff like, perhaps you don't know it, but the brain, the waves of your brain actually fly through the air and can contact the waves of other people. I mean, really, any intelligent person is just being slapped in the face by that. And that was really all I knew of patter, apart from the more decorative stuff like, John Mulholland type patter, where you tell a story about some ancient Chinese god whose statue vanished in the middle of the night and reappeared in some phantom way. All of that was all I knew as patter. Yeah. And so I decided that it would be interesting to try doing magic without speech and without music, and let my actions lie for me. Instead of lying verbally, let place my actions out there to allow the audience to decide what was going on, that is, to fool themselves. And it was very interesting what that does for me. I, as you can tell, I'm a sort of academic kind of guy. I don't speak in fire. I'm not, I don't speak like Bob Dylan writes poetry. I also don't speak with the kind of jagged, omnivorous vocabulary that somebody like Penn has that makes what he says is always, it's always layered. He'll pick a word from science, and he'll pick a word from rock and roll, and he'll throw them in together in a beautiful way, and with a voice and energy that is very good. I'm just not that kind of guy.
By the way, side note, I love the irony that you describe that dissonance as Penn's jagged, omnivorous voice.
Well, it is, yeah. I mean, he devours words from all different kinds of, from all different walks of life.
Yeah. No, I meant that was beautifully eloquent and poetic.
Thank you.
The way you describe him.
And so what I found was that when I didn't talk, the ballsiness of that, and didn't use music also, didn't have background music to keep people entertained. Mm-hmm. It gave me a kind of easy authority that enabled me to walk into difficult circumstances and take control by some of the methods that I learned. I found, for example, that if you yourself know where the plot of a trick is going, that is what matters most. If you know where it's going and you haven't revealed to them where it's going, they will be there going, okay, where's this going? What's he trying to do? The same way when you see a movie, you're always trying to say, oh, what's going to happen next? What's happening now? What is that person up to? Raising questions is a very strong piece of authority. And if you know the answers and they don't know yet, and you're gradually unfolding the information before them, and they're trying to catch up with you, this is a huge piece of huge authority getting method. And it works very well for me because by not talking, I don't have the opportunity to explain, so they just have to kind of catch on. The most shocking example of this that I can remember was from a long, long time ago when I was advertising a show that I was doing on the Princeton University campus with a rock band. And they said, well, you need to go into the Princeton University pub at, 9 o'clock at night on a Saturday and do something there that will advertise this show. The Princeton University pub it's a cylindrical building, right? And it has balconies, two or three levels of balconies around the outside, and tables in the middle of the floor. And on a Saturday night, the place is just a madhouse. So I had them turn off the music, which everybody yelled and screamed and said, what are you doing turning off the music? And I walked in and I did the needle trick. And at first, what they did was drop paper cups of beer on me, right, from the balconies. Smash, like little, like wonderful, like water balloons exploding on all sides. But I very calmly got somebody up and began swallowing the needles. And now people are going, what the fuck is he? What is he doing? What are those? Are those needles? What's going on? And by the end, the entire room was paying attention to what I was doing and gave me a huge round of applause. And and the whole thing was just, I knew where the story was going and they didn't. And they knew I knew.
Like you said, the one true question, what's really going on?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it forces people to use a different part of their brain too, I think, that they're not used to using, of just listening or just observing more so than I think they're used to observing, which is my favorite thing about visual art.
It's also very intimate.
Yeah.
I mean, without words as a curtain in front of you, without clothing yourself in words, you are kind of naked. You are looking at them. They're looking at you in a way that we just don't do that often with other people. Just think about, here you are in a room and you're face to face with somebody and you're not saying anything. You're looking in a different way. It's pretty sexy, actually. It has a sexual component to it. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's absurdly intimate. Yeah, there's you can feel it, in a different type of way.
Yeah. Shh, no words.
Yeah, yeah. When I first did the red ball trick, Jonesy wrote me this wonderful, Jonesy, our piano player in the Vegas show, wrote me this wonderful music to go with it. It was just great, absolutely great. And then one night, he suddenly had to have some rectal surgery and had to be out for a night, couldn't sit on his bench. So I thought, well, what am I going to use the recording of this? No, the recording won't sync up to what I'm doing. I think I'm just going to try to ballsy it out and not use the music. And we had used the music because Johnny said, oh, the ball trick is always done with music. Well, so Jonesy isn't there. There's no music. And suddenly I hear every breath the audience is taking.
Yeah.
Every breath. I hear every bounce of the ball. And the whole thing came alive for me. And it was quite a revelation.
Yeah.
The removal of something you thought was necessary is kind of profound sometimes in magic. It's one of my favorite things in the process of working on new things, is something you don't even comprehend. Okay, this has now been removed from you, and okay, make do. And it opens up a new door, which is, beautiful. It's great. Simon, did you have any questions? Simon had a whole bunch of questions that I don't know if we've hit them or not.
Here are two magicians, one mic. We like to keep it free form.
Very yeah. little preparation. I got my little post-it note right here. That's about it.
A couple of things. Something I'm always curious about, because I think about it a lot, is there, are there any things you find yourself, again, you get a lot of, oh my God, I didn't know you could talk, ha ha ha, and that will either be entertaining or annoying depending on the moment. But are there any?
Well, actually, let me yeah. interrupt you and say, it is always pleasant.
Gotcha.
It is always pleasant. I mean, some people will be a little smug about, you know, do you know what time it is? Yes. Oh, you're talking, ha ha ha. You know, that happens. Yeah. But yeah. every single one of those is someone saying, I know and like your work.
Sure.
That's what it translates yeah. to.
I mean, so, we experience this in a very micro level compared to you on cruise ships. It's like people are constantly trying to make the joke of the magician, make my wife disappear, make my bill disappear. And through that is a truth of, I really enjoyed your show. And yeah, 99% yeah. of the time, people are just trying to relate to you and be nice. So I
sure, yeah,
I understand that on a very tiny level.
Forgive me, Simon, you were in the middle of a question and I interrupted you.
And I was just going to follow up to Nick's thing, like trying to relate, often failing to, but at least trying, at least caring. And that's right. It's good to focus on that part. Is there anything you find yourself wishing people understood or knew about your arts and your crafts, you know, in magic, theater, all of the above? That, I mean, I find myself frequently trying to create material that shares and showcases some of the actual stuff we really do, the art, the craft, the nuance, because I realize I like that being understood. Do you have anything similar that you relate to that you try to bring visibility to through your work?
A great deal of the Penn and Teller material is based on the premise that every single person in the audience has read a magic book and has, you know, was a magic hobbyist for 2 months. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's what, you know, the reason that we have never been invited to join the magic circle in London, even though they have several of our props on exhibition as classic things, is that we freely play with the backstage view of magic. We think it's really interesting. Our piece Looks Simple is sort of the classic illustration of that. That's a trick. It's a sequence in which I light a cigarette, take a puff on it, throw it to the floor, stamp it out, and then light another cigarette. And then we explain how that trick is done. Mm-hmm. That trick is done with a series of elaborate sleight of hand moves, and we name all the sleight of hand moves like palming, switch, and so forth. The idea is a very rich one that I'm hoping we can get another bit out of someday. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of simulating commonplace reality through an intricate sequence of sleight of hand is just so interesting to me. Mm-hmm. Because it suggests that all of the world that we see normally, the grocery packer isn't really putting the groceries into your bag. The grocery packer is secretly palming the groceries out and loading them into the bag as they wheel it to your car. Mm-hmm. You know, that the idea that the world is just this magic show going on that we can't quite penetrate because it looks so ordinary is intriguing mm-hmm. to me.
Yeah. Well, I saw, I think it was on, I forget what show it was on way back. You were talking about that with a simple cup and ball load. Rather than placing the ball into the cup, you false transfer the ball, fake place it while covertly loading it. You end up in the same place, but via a much more circuitous route. I think that might have been one of the...
Yeah. Wasn't there a guy in Egypt that, when you guys did that Penn and Teller special in Egypt, that was one of the moments I remember you being so amazed at. He put in a false transfer like that just for you that nobody else would have caught.
Yeah, he was great. I mean, he was doing magic for magicians, mm-hmm. and he, you know, he did the perfect non-load when there was no load there. I don't remember exactly what he did, but he had me completely. I was sure I was well ahead of him, and I was well behind him.
Is there anything you find is, because you and Penn have both done so many different projects and kinds of projects, is there anything you find as sort of are there any unifying themes in the work for you? Or is it just you do whatever seems interesting at the time and go with it that way?
I mean, we have this great luxury of having much more success than we deserve. I mean, we really, and I do mean that. It's really true. Penn and I were, when we were playing in San Francisco from about 1977 to 80 or so, we were there with a third partner in a show called the Asparagus Valley Cultural Society, in a little theater that seated 143 people. We were making a fine living. We had our own apartments. We were saving money. We were eating well. We were having a blast. And that was my vision of what I would like to have as the top level of success that I could ever actually want. And then that show closed. We closed that show to do another show called Mrs. Lonsbury's Seance of Horror. That was an absolute flop, an utter flop. We told ourselves we could afford to lose $10,000 on it. We lost every penny. And we lost our self-respect. And we lost our confidence that our judgment was good. It took us 3 or 4 years to pick up the pieces, start all over again as a two-man group now, and to find ourselves venues where we could work. And in the course of this, we happened to play a theater in Los Angeles that was run by a wonderful woman named Susie Dietz, who knew a New York producer who happened to be breaking away from the theater that he had worked for years and wanted to open an off-Broadway show. And he flew out, he saw us, and he optioned us. And we thought, well, he's never going to take us to New York. So he's giving us $1,200. Well, I'll sign there. And then, you know, I don't know, 4 months later, he said, well, I'm taking you off Broadway. And we went, at this time, we actually had a small run going successfully in Los Angeles after at times playing for 4 and 5 people a night. And he said, no, I'm taking you to New York. And we said, well, please don't do that. Don't take us to New York. Don't. We're actually making money now for the first time in several years. And he said, well, I'll give you another couple of months out there. And then you got to come out in April. And we went with great trepidation saying, we're risking everything to go do this stupid thing of doing off Broadway. As it turned out, we happened by nothing except chance, really. We happened to be in the right place at the right time with the right combination of things and the right producer. The atmosphere was just right. Very few people have the good fortune to have that kind of lucky moment, you know, and that kind of lucky moment only comes if you're not looking for it, right? If your ambition is, I want to be on Broadway, well, good luck. You can have that sort of ambition. If your ambition is, I'd like to do the best show I can, you can do that for the rest of your life. And if you happen to get lucky, well, then maybe you do get lucky. And we did. You know, we happened to be in a perfect little theater in New York. The producer was brilliant. And I should tell you this thing about this producer. He said, I'm not going to tell the press what you guys are. We said, what is that? What do you mean? He said, I'm just going to call you Penn and Teller. There will be no little subheading. You know, no, the bad boys of magic. I'm no little subheading. In fact, I want to say to you guys, magic is the M word. You are not ever to mention this word. Because if you mention this word in connection with a show, this is at that time, this is 1985. If you mention that word in connection with the show, people from the suburbs will drive their station wagons in and drop off their children, and no first string critic will ever come to it. So we're going to call you Penn and Teller, and your poster will be a cartoon of a big guy and a little guy handcuffed together. That's all the poster will be. They will decide what you are. I mean, that lucking into a producer with that level of genius,
yeah.
I mean, that's just genius, was quite something. And then, of course, he knew things that mattered in New York. He engaged a director who was helpful to us. He hired the most legitimate possible set designer to design our minimal set, the most legitimate possible lighting designer and sound designer. So, when the New York Times came in, they were coming into a show that had a lot of credibility, in spite of the fact that the stars themselves had no credibility at all.
Yeah,
that's amazing. It's funny,
I remember that overlaps a lot with what. Probably a year or two ago, I called you up asking for advice about trying to get a show off the ground. And you said basically of that, but also that basically plan for the marathon, not the sprint. You know, it might never be successful. If it is, it'll be because of a random lucky thing. Just so make sure you're loving it enough to do it for its own sake so that you can keep doing it and keep working on it for its own sake.
That's, you know, that is the kind of thing that Malcolm Gladwell is talking about when he talks about the 10,000 hours that you need to put in. You need to put in the 10,000 hours because you like putting in those 10,000 hours. And never forgetting that there isn't really a payoff to life other than death. You know, that the time that you spend is happening now, and you'd better be savoring what you're doing.
Is there anything you miss about those pre sort of mega success days? Obviously things are great right now. Is there anything you miss about the old times? Are there any drawbacks to your success?
I mean, I'm certainly working a lot harder now than I did in those days. Because, you know, if you have one show a month, that's very different from having nightly shows and having, say, something like Fool Us requiring 13 new bits for each season. So I work very hard. But the fact that I'm working very hard, it doesn't bother me. In fact, I love it. So I guess I don't get as much downtime, although I'm getting a plenty heaping helping of it right now. And there was a point last week where I thought, I wonder if this whole thing is just happening in my mind. I wonder if this entire thing is just happening in my mind, and I'm just imagining that I suddenly have the time that I've been looking for all this time. And the cost of it is that the rest of the world is dying. Mm-hmm. Ugh, how horrible. What a horrible nightmarish thought. I think that would be about the only difference. I just got very lucky, you know. That's no false humility. I just got lucky.
I heard, I can't remember who said it, but it was something like, when you said, you know, we have more success than we deserve, and someone would say something like, don't get me wrong, we deserve a lot, but we've had way more than that.
The sea change in one's life is this moment when you can earn your living doing what you love. That's the sea change, you know, and it happened to me. The first year I quit teaching, and I was a school teacher for 6 years before I went into magic. And I took a year's leave of absence because I thought that would be a prudent way if I was starving in an alley at the end of my year of magic, I could go back and be a school teacher for the rest of my life. Took a year's leave of absence. And then I remember waking up one September day and going, oh my gosh, this is the first time in 22 years that I have not been in school, either as a student or as a teacher. I don't have to get up in the morning and either write or grade papers. I can get up and I can put a bunch of coins in a bucket and experiment with the miser's dream. I can do that. That's what I do now. And that you know, and I was, at that point, we were trying to launch a show in a theater. We did the worst publicity stunt ever. I mean, the most highly, you know, Asparagus Penn's Unicycle Leap for Life, which is this catastrophic attempt at a publicity stunt that ended up damaging cars and getting people injured, getting Penn beaten and spat upon. That was our opening gambit in starting a theater career. And that run finished and made no money. And then we thought, well, we should be playing colleges or something, because we didn't know what our audience was. And that wasn't succeeding. But between times we did Renaissance festivals, you know, I did the Cups and Balls, Miser's Dream and the Needles, and did ball and knife juggling. And we went to Philadelphia and we did streets in Philadelphia and made decent money on the streets. So I was actually making money doing what I loved, and it was miraculous. And nothing since then has been anything like that change.
There's a story at the end of, I think, Penn's more recent book, Every Day is an Atheist Holiday, where he talks about seeing two performers in a kind of a small nightclub stage in Vegas, and, you know, just lamenting of how, if that ends up being you guys, where you're performing in a room of, you know, not many people, you'd still be thrilled. You'd still be happy just to be performing together. You know, is that still true? Is that sentiment? It seems like it from what you've just said, that's still very factual.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The difference between performing for an audience of 30 and an audience of 3,000 is very small. I think it was Alan Rossi that we were seeing, and it was, there weren't very many people there, but Alan and Rossi were having a blast because they were doing what they loved. That's where I saw Frank Gorshin, you know, who famous as the Joker on the Batman series. Mm-hmm. Frank Gorshin, the greatest impressionist who ever lived, doing an exquisite act and working a small room for people who were absolutely delighted by him. That's fine. That's good.
Yeah, small rooms are sometimes way better. I think my favorite audience size is about 50 to 100.
Yeah.
It's not as profitable, but oh God, I love it. When it's a small, little, tightly packed room where the crowd is really with you, oh, the things mm-hmm. you can do with that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're experiencing the individuality of each person coming at you.
Yeah.
Yeah. As we wrap up here, Simon, anything else you wanted to throw in?
No, it's just been a pleasure to chat. It's been ages. Glad you're doing well.
Yeah, we're glad you're healthy and well.
Yeah, I know, so far, you know, we just have to stay really careful and really skeptical.
Yeah, as always, what's really going on?
Mm-hmm. I mean, we always like to end the show. I mean, you kind of just gave us one, which is a great one with your publicity stunt, but we always ask kind of like crazy, weird things that have happened on stage. Anything, I mean, I'm sure there's thousands, but anything ever stand out or something just absurd that you're like, how do I deal with this?
How do I deal with this? Penn and I are not particularly good at witty covers. you know, the night that I might have this wrong, but one night we were in the middle of doing the bullet catch, and the person from the audience grabbed the gun. There's nothing to do there except send the person back to the audience, and that's what we did.
Wow.
There was one night when I was doing the, I was about to do the needles, and I invited the guy up to hold the apple that has the needles in it, and he came up to the edge of the stage, and when he got to the top of the stairs, he walked over to me on his knees, you know, just walking across the stage on his knees. And I shook his hand, gave him a round of applause, and sent him back to his seat. this is kind of one of those more amusing stories. But we were, I think, playing Chicago, and we were doing the water tank. And that's a trick where I'm locked in a sort of a phone booth full of water, determined to hold my breath until Penn succeeds in doing a card trick. And during the course of it, he fails with the card trick. I drown and die, and the signed card ends up in my diving mask. So the water tank had been shipped rather roughly. Mm. It had cracked. So we were on stage doing that trick, and the water was leaking out onto the stage. But more important for the drama of the trick, it was the level of the water was coming down so that it was allowing me to breathe. So Robbie Liven, our great crew boss of many, 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 many years, who always wears a Borsellino hat and is somebody you would never fuck with. Robbie Liven comes out on stage with bucket after bucket of water to continue to fill the tank in order for me to be able to drown.
I love that so much. Great.
Yeah.
That's, yeah, make sure we can kill this guy.
Yeah, no, we gotta kill him.
Yeah, he had all the priorities straight. Doesn't matter if the stage is filled with water. We just have to be sure the guy can drown.
And I'm sure I would venture to say more than half the audience assumed that was just part of it.
they might well have. I don't know. They do seem to very often give you credit when you don't deserve it.
It is such a beautiful thing when you have moments like that. This is one of the reasons Nick and I have been working on this Improv Magic SmackDown show together for a while. And it's so beautiful when you're working with people who get it and have got your back. Just when you can just cross, yep, they've got it under control.
Yeah, we are learning. The show's usually three people, but we were learning kind of what you and Penn go through. It's very nice, having been a solo performer for so long, even if it's a day where you're not getting along, it is nice to have somebody else on stage that you can kind of share these absurd moments with. It's very special.
Well, we have a crew, most of whom have worked with us for at least 20 years.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So they are remarkable. I mean, they are absolutely remarkable. They, you know, we the last week that we were performing before we did Fool Us, we were making changes in the show order, which in a big theater show is no small thing. I mean, it's changing the whole lighting cue, all that sort of thing. We were making big changes like that almost nightly. And the crew would just say, okay, what's it going to be? Oh, never the same show once. And, you know, and they would just roll with it. We've had times where things have technically failed. Well, you know, one of the things that's really important, as you know, is always to have something that you could, that's the go-to cover for the emergency kind of trick. So for us, it's the needles and the fire reading. Right, the Penn's fire eating monologue. We were performing in Vermont in the middle of winter, and in a small rustic theater, and the entirety of the power of the town went out. Right, the entirety of the power of the town went out. So, okay, fire eating. Penn brought out the torches. Did the fire eating, we ended the show, and the audience was perfectly satisfied. We now carry battery-powered stage lights that our crew can whip out when the entire power of the building goes down.
I'm right. That's the good stuff.
Yeah, planning for the unplannable. That's insane.
But that's our crew, and they can read, and they just read our minds basically.
Sure, yeah, they know the show probably better than you guys do at this point, I would assume.
I'm sure they do.
Actually, there was one other thing I was going to tell her. You were, it's a small story that you were present for, but it's an additional angle I think you might enjoy, which was when I came to visit you all to do closing the show as the Fool Us Prize in Vegas, and had an amazing time, and it was just such a wonderful experience. And then we were all backstage in the Monkey Room afterwards, hanging out and chatting. And I was there with my friends Tim and Amanda, who were also in the room. And we were just chatting about magic and the poker chip trick and everything. And at one point you said, and I may be paraphrasing from memory, but you started a sentence where, yeah, it's a really beautiful trick. I think it's probably one of my favorite pieces. And I waited for you to sort of ellipsis into that season or in that show, and then you just didn't end the sentence. And then Tim and Amanda and I just shared this glance, and they got to just see my eyes widen of like, did he just fucking say that? Holy shit.
I mean, that poker chip routine is a masterpiece. I mean, it is for my sense of what the word masterpiece should mean, it is, because you've so perfectly dovetailed the ideas and the trick, and it's so spare and it's so funny. I mean, it's just it's one of those things that you see that you go, okay, I've now seen that, and it's that is what I would call a masterpiece, and that's what I meant.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Well, you know, in that case, you'll probably appreciate even more thinking of some of the stories you've told of how you met Johnny over the years. Is that trick is still, to me, very unfinished. I still think there are a couple of bits that could be slightly better about it that I'm still working on. I don't see it in any way finished.
I'm sure you see it that way, and that is how it got that good.
Yeah.
Because you kept seeing what was wrong with it, or what could be better in it, and making it better. To someone who has not been on the inside of that process, I see only this exquisite, you know, gem. Mm-hmm. But there are things that I've done for, I have to calculate this, 20, more than 50 years, that I'm actually writing up for my journal of some of the Penn and Teller stuff, that when I watch it, I think, oh, I know what I could do to make that better. That moment that I made better before could be better. It could be better if I just time things differently. If I've, among other things, I mean, I don't want to spoil the neat ending of your podcast, but here's the thing that magicians don't know, and that it took me 50 years to realize. It's that anytime you move fast, it's a sign that you're doing something wrong. Almost any time that you move fast. And for me, that's particularly visible. And in this one routine that I'm writing up, there's a place where I move too fast. And I spent the last year when I've been doing it, just trying to slow down. And now that I've slowed it down, I go, oh yes, and that's also not quite right yet. Mm. But that fast thing, the other thing that magicians do that just drives me crazy is they believe that if they catch an audience's eye by looking up at them, you know, with this insipid grin, that the audience will, for that moment, will not look at their hands. Oh, come. Bless their hearts. That's not the way it works. If you do that, that's a tell. It's a tell. In this season's Fool Us, we teach the French drop, and we talk about Penn's tell and my tell. Penn's tell is he speeds up. My tell is I look up at the audience with an insipid grin. our friend Doc Swan said, tell teller his tell is he raises his eyebrows. And then I realized that raising my eyebrows is I'm going for this look of innocence, wide-eyed innocence. So not to raise my eyebrows at the moment that I'm doing the critical move is very difficult.
I'm now going through every silent bit I do, realizing I do the same exact thing. That's really funny.
It's really something. It's magician's guilt is so hard to overcome.
Yeah, even when you know what's happening. Speaking of that, particularly of the more famous things, you know, the bullet catch, all the things that people would know, are there any of those that jump out at you as things where there are things you really think could be better that you're still thinking about?
Yes.
Without any spoilers, are there any you can talk about, like a timing thing or a bit you wish was clearer? I think it's fascinating because people, again, see the outside. They see, oh my God, this thing's perfect. I think it's really interesting to know the mind of the creator behind it, what he or she is thinking about.
I believe that most of the bullet catch is good. I believe there is one move in it that I will not identify that is not good. It is done way too fast. And that's just like putting a neon circle around it. We're always looking for those moments. And you know, then there's the directorial thing that's so difficult. And you, as people who work in a partnership, know you have to come in at the moment when the other person is actually ready for a piece of direction. One of the things that made our partnership very difficult for about the first, I don't know, 25 or 30 years was that I would tend to recognize something that was a problem and raise it to Penn when he was thinking about something entirely different. Now I know that I do that, and Penn knows that I do that, and over the last 10 years or so we have learned to deal with the emotional complexity of that. We've learned to bring a critical observation in at the right time and with the right amount of true casualness. I don't mean faked casualness, but I mean, here's something I've noticed that I think is could be better if we did it this way. And to just be able to know how to have those conversations was a real game changer. This last year of Fool Us material, for example, was a total pleasure to work on because we had both learned when to talk about something and also how to receive that kind of thing, even if it grates on you, with the right level of relaxation. It's very difficult, especially when you have two people as violently opinionated as Penn and I are about things. I mean, early on somebody said they're not two people you would invite to the same party.
There has always been that great duality in your natures, hasn't there?
I'll go for it, buddy.
The different ways we like to take and give notes. It's almost like love languages or communication styles. That's something I'm thinking about because I know how I like to get notes, but it's very different to a lot of people I know and how they prefer to get them.
How do you like to get notes?
I just like them direct, brutal, straightforward. I don't like the being sugar-coated. To me, that's an annoying waste of time. It's just tell me the thing sucks and what sucks about it, and I'm good. But that's weird. That's me being unusual. I don't think that's better. That's just, and everyone's
good. It's certainly easier for the other person.
Yeah, but the thing is, weirdly, it's not, though, because most people are so trained to know that if they do that, the person will react badly and get angry at them. And it's something I've noticed when I work with people. I now sort of say, hey, by the way, please constantly give me direct, like, don't sugarcoat it, just give me the note immediately. And then it's making me think more about chatting with people. Like, yeah, how would you like to get constructive feedback? Would you like it then and there? Would you like it afterwards? Would you like it sugarcoated? Like, you know, in a non-tense moment, long before it's actually time to give notes.
It'd be right.
A really effective way to approach creative partnerships.
It's a very complex thing. I think both Penn and I have gotten to be more like you in the last 10 years. But still, what I always have to remember is that Penn is thinking first and foremost about the content of what he's saying. Mm. That is the absolute top priority for him. And until he has that sorted out in his head, any little notes about, you know, you're tipping this too much this way or that way is just going to annoy him, because he's wrestling with this very complex conundrum, and he doesn't need the distraction of being told, well, you're flashing this at that moment.
Yeah.
Although that's one of the easier ones.
Yeah, it's good. Well, it makes me think about when I worked with Shudagawa on quite a few shows, and we have this interesting dichotomy. We both care deeply about the magic, but I also care slightly more about the narrative than he does. Mm-hmm. And he cares slightly more about the magic routining than I do. And it's good, because we both, again, the different prioritizations that people have in a moment. And all these things are important, but at different times.
I mean, I believe that you always want to work with somebody that you are essentially inclined to fight with.
Yeah.
You always want to work with somebody whose perspective is different enough from yours that it's not two people agreeing. Two people agreeing makes no progress at all. You know, you need two different things to make a baby, right?
And then learn how to fight well.
Yeah, learn how to fight. I mean, one of the most important things is simply to say, we will always exhibit good manners. We will always say please, thank you. We will never yell, and we do not do any of that. I mean, there are moments where I'm sorry, I have to go right now, you know, and you leave and you calm down. But we do that so as not to demoralize the crew and everybody else.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's a marriage, you know. It's you have to treat each other with respect, especially when you disagree.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
There will always be conflict, but we can handle it gracefully and well and constructively, as opposed to the alternative.
Yep.
Well, this has just been a treat. You know, when I started this podcast in 2012 and nobody was listening, I never thought we'd be able to get somebody like you on. So I really appreciate you taking the time during this weird, crazy quarantine experience that we're all having and, you know, chatting with us for a bit. It's been fun.
Thank you. I agree. I've enjoyed it very much.
Well, maybe again sometime in a year or so, see how it's all going.
Yeah, well, maybe we could wrestle with some question like, what is misdirection?
Oh, let's go.
I like that.
Yeah, I have some things to say about that.
So. All right. Well, let's talk.
All right.
Well, then stay safe, okay. Stay healthy, stay creative.
You too. You too.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. Please give us 5 stars on the Apple Podcast. If you really like the show, you can donate a few bucks a month on our website, twomagiciansonemike.com, or become a monthly subscriber through our Patreon link. Thanks to all the people that support the show and keep it up and running. Be sure to follow us on the interwebs at @twomagiciansonemike. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great week.